to find out that it was a serial killer. It was extremely surreal.
They were the worst crime scene photos that I've seen in my career.
He seemed like he wanted to set some kind of world record killing people.
A Texas drifter claims he committed hundreds of brutal murders.
He was confessing to killing by stabbing, by bludgeoning, by running people over, shooting them.
Cops from all over the country were calling, wanting to talk about their unsolved cases.
But do police have the real killer behind bars?
There were no fingerprints. There was no physical evidence linking him to these crimes.
Why don't they prove that I did the crime? You understand?
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. It's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Ron Rosenbaum uncovers the secrets to one man's dead reckoning.
This part of Austin, it was primarily just residential, middle class.
It was a suburban neighborhood, lots of kids riding their bikes.
73-year-old Mildred McKinney lives on Sherbourne Street.
My grandmother was a very thoughtful woman. She was always doing things for other people and doing things for her family and trying to spend time whenever possible with us.
Bob Stapleton's parents, Robert and Patricia, stop by Mildred McKinney's house. Patricia likes to check in on her mother. Right away, she senses something is wrong.
It was typical that Mildred would draw her curtains open when she woke up for the day, and the curtains were still drawn.
They noticed the back door was ajar, and there was something odd about it.
She kept everything just meticulous. Everything had a place, and everything was put in its place. But now, there were some things on the floor. Silverware, other things just in kind of disarray. They went back to Mildred's back bedroom, and that's when they found her dead on the floor. She had been hogtied. There was furniture on top of her, but you could still see her face, and she was just beaten so bad.
This by far is the worst crime scene photos that I've seen in my career. She had been struck in the face with such force that a tooth had cut through her cheek. She had severe bruising to her ears, to her eyebrows, to her chest, her arms.
It looked like this crime had taken place over the course of a long time. It wasn't something that someone broke in and just did quickly. They tortured her. Her daughter and her son-in-law went down the street and asked for the police to be called.
I was 12. I was called to the school office very unexpectedly. And my dad was sitting in a chair sobbing. I think he first said that she was dead and followed through that she had been killed. After that, everything was very sketchy in my memory.
The family and the authorities are stunned by the viciousness of the attack.
There was evidence of a sexual assault. The medical examiner was able to find DNA evidence. He was able to make slides of. Those were then sent off to the crime lab.
But the science of DNA analysis has yet to evolve. The sample slides provide no quick answers. Investigators instead focus on one suspect, Bob Stapleton's father, Robert.
I think they suspected my father for the same reasons you see on any crime drama you ever hear about. They always look at the family first.
Back then, it was known that Mildred didn't care for him very much, and he didn't really care for her very much. And Mr. Stapleton kind of presented himself in a suspicious manner. Law enforcement asked to speak to him, and he did speak to them briefly. But when they wanted to speak to him more, he decided to have an attorney.
While police suspect Robert Stapleton killed his mother-in-law, they have no proof. Bob remembers the constant surveillance and harassment of his father.
They were fairly aggressive in the long term. A drive-by once in a while over many years really added up. They felt like they were under a microscope. It really took a toll on their lives.
You know, law enforcement just to kind of stop looking around for anybody else.
Four years later, police announced that a man arrested for another crime has confessed to killing Mildred McKinney.
I remember standing in the breakfast room when my parents told me that this person had confessed to doing it. Henry Lee Lucas.
It's hard to find an overall characterization of Lucas. When I was researching the story, Lucas told me about his childhood. And the story he told was so awful.
His father was an alcoholic who had both legs amputated in an accident when he was drunk.
His mother was a prostitute, bootlegger, and a real hellcat, apparently. She terrorized him.
His mother brought men over to the house to have sex with in front of her children. She dressed him as a girl for the first 5 or 6 years of his life.
It was a pretty wretched childhood.
Lucas leaves home in his early teens, but returns in 1960 with some good news, or so he thought.
Lucas said that he wanted to tell his mother that he met some young lady he was gonna marry, and she didn't approve of this. They're both drunk, and they got into a fight.
He woke up in the middle of the night to her beating him around the head with a broom handle.
And he swung with a little penknife that he carried and nicked her throat. The cut didn't kill her, but she fell on the floor and then died about an hour later from a heart attack.
In June of 1960, Lucas is convicted of second-degree murder. He is sentenced to 20 to 40 years. He serves 10.
After Henry was released, the story he told was the story of kind of lower depths of American life.
Lucas was a drifter. He had no steady job, no place to live, so he just went where life took him.
Eventually, Lucas finds his way to the small Texas town of Ringgold, just south of the Oklahoma border. Eighty-year-old Kate Rich is missing.
The family members had already told the sheriff that there was a guy that had lived there for a while that they had kicked out. They told him that his name was Henry Lucas.
Lucas is hired by the family to do errands for the elderly woman in exchange for room and board. Staying with him, his 15-year-old girlfriend, Becky Powell. But the arrangement doesn't last long.
Kate's daughters realized that they was not doing any good for her. They was running up bills at the local store on her that her Social Security check wouldn't cover. So they came and evicted them.
Phil Ryan is assigned to investigate Kate's disappearance. He learns that Henry Lee Lucas was the last person to see her.
The evening that Kate disappeared, Henry said he was gonna go get Kate and said she wanted to come to church, but they didn't show up there.
Lucas becomes the prime suspect in the disappearance of Kate Rich. But there is not enough evidence to charge him, so authorities get a warrant to hold him for possession of an illegal weapon.
He looked at me and said, "I always heard that in Texas, if you couldn't get them one way, you get them another way." And I said, "Well, that's about the size of it, Henry."
2 weeks later, Henry Lee Lucas tells his jailers that he's ready to talk.
I get a call. "Come on down here." Well, what I think had happened is, sitting alone in his cell with nobody to talk to, all these demons started coming out of his mind. They just went to hell in a handbasket just overnight.
What Henry Lee Lucas confesses to police fascinates and horrifies the entire nation. Henry Lee Lucas is in a Texas jail, the chief suspect in the disappearance of 80-year-old Kate Rich. At first, Lucas denies knowing anything about it. 2 weeks later, Lucas is ready to confess.
He wrote probably the best unsolicited confession you ever saw. He told me he killed Kate Rich between his house and her house, and move the body back to his apartment and burn it in his wood-burning stove over a several-day period.
Police find bone fragments in a pile of ashes from the stove. As investigators begin documenting the crime scene, Lucas confesses to yet another murder.
He said, "I killed Becky, the only girl I ever loved."
Lucas tells investigators that he was arguing with his girlfriend about whether to return to Florida, where Becky Powell was born.
He said Becky slapped him. He said, "Just reflexed. I stuck a knife in her, and she just fell over." In his words, he said, "Me and Becky talked it over, and we thought it was best to cut her up and bury her." He said, "I'll take you out there, but it's not pretty." He said, "Now, if you just dig right there, there'll be a pillowcase with some of her." He said, "I think the legs, I drug off that away, the head's over this way."
Authorities identify the remains of 15-year-old Becky Powell. But Lucas is not done talking.
I was wanting to get a little background on him, sort of his life history, and then he went to spouting off all kinds of murders. He covered murders all across the United States, giving some specific details, names, items that he took off of them, jewelry that he took off of them, and then he would draw pictures of these girls.
He ended up with about 77 descriptions of murders he'd committed.
It seemed like he wanted to set some kind of world record killing people. It was a nightmare sitting there, and it makes you want to just choke somebody that could even sit there and describe murders.
It's a small town, and word spreads quickly. Monte County authorities have a serial killer in custody.
Henry Lee Lucas says he's a mass murderer. So far, he's led police to the bodies of two women, and he claims he has killed many more.
This buzz started about all these crimes he was confessing to, and it was like some mosquito-borne virus that just spread across the country overnight. And cops from all over the country were calling, wanting to talk about their unsolved cases.
5 months after his first confessions, Henry Lee Lucas is moved from Monte County to the Williamson County Prison in Georgetown, Texas.
The phone was constantly ringing with officers wanting to set up an appointment to talk to him about murders in their jurisdiction. We provided an interview room for him. We had a United States map on the wall in the office, and whenever officers would come out and talk with him, if they believed he was responsible for the crime, they'd put a pin there at their location.
Henry was a one-of-a-kind serial killer.
Lucas was confessing to killing all sorts of people using all sorts of different means. He was confessing to sexual murders, killing by stabbing, by bludgeoning, by choking, by running people over, shooting them. If there was a murder out there, he did it.
By November 1983, Henry Lee Lucas has claimed responsibility for almost 200 murders.
Usually when people write about the serial killers in America, the most common is 6 or 7. If he had killed 200 people, if he'd killed 100, he would have been the worst in history.
The Texas Rangers form a special task force to coordinate the endless string of confessions. Investigators from across the country fly Henry Lee Lucas to various crime scenes. The nation is transfixed and sickened by this unprecedented killing spree.
There was enormous media involvement in the case. What could be in a more enormous story, say we got a guy who said he killed hundreds of people? You have to cover it.
He became a worldwide phenomenon.
Police now linked Lucas to scores of murders in 17 states, stretching from coast to coast.
Lucas said he would kill anybody for any reason. It went up to almost 600 people he said he killed.
The numbers are shocking, but Lucas says he didn't kill alone. He had an accomplice, Otis Toole.
Henry Lee Lucas said, Otis Toole will confirm this. And in fact, Otis Toole did confirm it.
If any person was very scary, I'd say Otis Toole was scary. He was just a beast of a man.
Otis Toole was a repetitive arsonist. He was a transvestite. He was just plain bizarre.
Otis Toole was some character. When I went down to meet Otis Toole in Florida, I have to admit, when I was alone in the cell with him, I was not very comfortable, let's say.
Henry Lee Lucas met Otis Toole in Florida in 1979. Lucas claims the pair crisscrossed the country, murdering their victims on behalf of a Satan-worshipping cult called the Hands of Death.
Now we're in this level of absurd horror. It was a time in America where there was this serial killer, satanic witchcraft panic.
Lucas and Toole's confessions are deeply disturbing, but at least their victims' relatives would finally have answers, including Mildred McKinney's family.
In late December of 83, investigators from Williamson County went to Florida, where Otis Toole was. He explains in detail the events that occurred in the murder of Mildred McKinney. Henry Lee Lucas also wrote a statement. He pretty much said that Otis Toole was the one that was responsible for the death, but that he was there and burglarized the house.
Lucas and Toole are both charged with the murder of Mildred McKinney.
Henry gave families closure. It's terrible what happened, but at least we can pin it on this horrible person.
It was extremely surreal to find out that it was a serial killer. Just sort of raised the magnitude of what had happened. He did it. He was the one. We could put that chapter behind us.
But neither the victims' families nor the police are prepared for the next, even more shocking twist in the case of Henry Lee Lucas. 5 years before Henry Lee Lucas is arrested, a man is walking on County Road 150 near Georgetown, Texas. Something in the grass catches his attention.
The passerby located a wallet. That was Kevin Key's wallet. Shortly thereafter, police discovered Kevin's body off the side of the road in some grass. Kevin had multiple gunshot wounds to his back. Autopsy later revealed it was .22 caliber bullets that had caused Kevin's death.
He had just turned 19. I can't even begin to explain the emotions that you feel. Anger, just such anger. I wanted to go find the person that did it and shoot him.
The last time I saw Kevin was the night before when he was going out on a date. He was really excited about a new girl that he met named Rita.
In 1978, Rita Salazar was 18 years old. She was a young lady, had her whole life ahead of her.
She liked to dance. She was a cheerleader. And she wanted to be a cheerleader for the Cowboys.
The same night of Kevin's murder, there were reports of gunshots near Waco, Texas, about 75 miles away from where Kevin was killed. The next morning, a unidentified female body was found by McLennan County Sheriff's officers. She was discovered fully clothed, but in the autopsy, there was evidence that sperm may have been present. In 1978, we weren't up on DNA, but investigators and the medical examiner did a great job of retaining that evidence.
Rita Salazar's mother calls to report her missing. The police ask her to come downtown.
We went to the courthouse and they end up showing me just some clothes. And that's when I told them they were hers. I went crazy. I couldn't believe it.
Even though Rita and Kevin were found 75 miles apart, investigators confirm they were killed with the same weapon. The police follow up on all potential clues, but the leads go nowhere.
The case went cold. Investigators maintained a file and periodically would work on this case, but they had no further leads.
Well, I just waited and waited, and they never called us, so I just thought they were not going to find anybody.
5 years later, the family's wait comes to an end. Henry Lee Lucas confesses to the murders of Kevin Key and Rita Salazar.
Where did she hurt him? He's long shaped file. Remember how many times the shot it? Well, four times, I think it's actually.
He even told the sheriff to tell me that Rita fought on her last until her last minute. And I said, well, I knew she was gonna fight.
Lucas did so many different types of murders. So I thought, well, you know, at least he was shot and he didn't go through the suffering that some people went through.
By 1985, Henry Lee Lucas has been convicted of 10 murders, one of which sends him to death row. But not everyone is convinced that Henry Lee Lucas is telling the truth.
Once the numbers became staggering, people then began to question, hey, how did this guy, he killed 100, now we're up to 200, 300, 600. It began to sound absolutely ridiculous.
I was the national correspondent with the Dallas Times Herald. I was extremely skeptical. And the first I heard about it was when a friend, Hugh Ainsworth, got interested in the story and asked me if I wanted to work with him. The first thing I did was put everything in a chronological order. And there was one that just jumped off of the wall. They would have had to have driven 10,000 miles to kill five or six people. And it was completely absurd.
They found it was almost physically impossible for Henry to have killed all these people.
The reporters create a paper trail that discredits over 200 of Henry Lee Lucas's confessions.
Work records, dental appointments. He was as easy to track as anybody else. That's why I thought, you know, this ball game's over. This was all a big hoax. I was ready to go start writing and just get it in the paper.
The story runs on the front page of the Dallas Times-Herald in April of 1985.
It was an enormous embarrassment for everybody who was involved in the case.
In the wake of the expose, Lucas appears before a grand jury in Waco. District Attorney Vic Fiesel now has doubts about at least three murders in his jurisdiction that Henry Lee Lucas claims he committed.
Vic Fiesel wanted to get Lucas to McLennan County and question him about everything that he could, I guess. And that's when he started recanting.
Under oath, Henry Lee Lucas recants nearly every single confession he made over the past 22 months. He now claims he only killed three people.
He said he did kill his mom and Kate Rich and Becky. The other ones were all a hoax. He lied to all of us.
According to Henry, as long as he kept confessing, he would get a special jail cell with cable TV.
Lucas, before he was arrested, was an absolute nobody. He was the bottom of the barrel. Once he started confessing, he became a celebrity, almost overnight.
Before DNA evidence, a confession was one of the key pieces of hard evidence lawmen relied on to get a conviction.
Back in the early 80s, if you confessed to a murder, you did it. Nobody even questioned this.
There were no fingerprints. There was no physical evidence linking Henry to these crimes.
What was it up to? 600 at one time? I mean, it was ridiculous. And I knew it was ridiculous. Our task force knew it was ridiculous. But when you pass it to the local guy, it's his call. It ain't ours.
I think that he did, at a certain point, discover that he could play the less sophisticated lawmen. According to Henry, one thing that law enforcement likes to do is to clear cases.
During many interviews that Henry Lee conducted at that time, they asked leading questions.
Henry Lee Lucas was a careful listener. He could sift through the details of a crime and figure out how he could take the credit.
They would say, "What's he look like, Henry?" Then he would say, "Well, she had blonde hair." Are you sure it was blonde? Well, yeah, it was kind of a dark blonde. I'd call it brown. Okay, he got it.
Just like taking a test, he would ace it.
There were all kinds of flags that somebody should have picked up on.
Even though Lucas recants his confession, he remains on death row. And the hundreds of murder cases that he once took credit for go cold.
There were all these cases where somebody committed murders and no one was trying to solve them. If the Lucas confessions were the lies, whether it was 77, 100, 150, that meant that there were 77, 150 murderers out there who actually did commit those crimes, still out there roaming, maybe committing other murders.
The families of Mildred McKinney, Rita Salazar, and Kevin Key are left wondering, who are the real killers? And if law enforcement stops looking, will they ever be brought to justice? A newspaper expose proves Henry Lee Lucas's claims that he murdered hundreds of people in a coast-to-coast crime spree was a hoax. Lucas now admits he made it all up.
In the past, he has confessed to more than 600 killings.
Now he says those confessions were a hoax. If Lucas didn't kill all of those people, who did?
In 1978, Rita Salazar and Kevin Key went out on a date in Austin, Texas. Lucas claimed he murdered the couple that night. He did not.
All those lies, I didn't read newspapers at all. I didn't see the news. I didn't want to see anything on the news.
I did lose hope. I think probably about after year 10 or year 20, I resolved that it was not going to be solved.
This case was cold for over 20 years at this point. And in December of 2008, I was approached by the district attorney and assigned this case. Investigators saved the evidence. And a DNA profile was developed. That information was put into a database and tested against felons in the state of Texas. In 2008, we were notified that the DNA matched a man named Benny Tiarena Jr.
Tiarena is a petty criminal with 23 arrests in the past 30 years. Now 50 years old, Tiarena has just been released from jail after serving time for a probation violation.
I get a call on my cell phone saying, we think we have a suspect in your brother's case. It was so surreal. I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe it.
We met with Rita Salazar's mother. This is a lady who I believe has always mourned the loss of her daughter.
I just told them I didn't believe that they were still looking. That's when they told me that no, they hadn't stopped looking, but I thought they had.
It's one of the proudest moments in my career when we were able to tell her that we intended to seek an indictment for capital murder of Benny Tiarena.
Michael Jarrett and his team tracked down Tiarena at his mother's home in Dallas. He agrees to come in for questioning.
He came to the police station and talked for several hours with investigators. Benny Tiarena said he was with two other people, that they had gone to Austin to party, and that on their return to Dallas, they found Kevin and Rita in a broken down vehicle.
Just being young, carefree teenagers, he didn't pay attention to how much gas was actually in the tank.
According to Tiarena, they had picked up the travelers in a town called Round Rock, and both of them had initially gotten in the backseat of the car.
Tiarena says they drove about 15 miles, and then his two companions dragged Kevin out of the car and shot him.
They returned to the vehicle and kept going north up I-35. Rita was driven towards the Dallas area, and at some point during that drive, the sexual assault occurred. When they were finished with her, they took her out on near mile marker 325 and executed her as well.
Tiarena, in a plea deal, admits to both murders.
What was very clear through the evidence is he raped Rita Salazar. And under the law in Texas, if he was a party to the rape, he was a party to the murder.
Benny Tiarena is sentenced to 40 years in prison.
For so many years, I was just tormented by Kevin's death. And who did it? It was such a big relief to find out that justice was finally being served.
I was just glad he wound up in jail after 30 years. You know, he had his life and used it, and he didn't let my daughter use it. He can stay in there as long as I'm concerned.
Benny Tiarena does name his alleged accomplices, but investigators have been unable to find them.
We always knew that Benny Tiarena did not drive the car, hold them at gunpoint, kill them, and rape Rita Salazar all on his own. Because of the investigators' belief that somebody else out there could be involved, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office will maintain an open file on this, and if there's any further information, they will investigate it, as they always will.
the Key and Salazar families finally know what really happened to Kevin and Rita. But Mildred McKinney's relatives continue to struggle with Henry Lee Lucas's lies.
I personally never thought the killer would be found. Didn't think it could happen.
Who really killed Mildred McKinney? It will take decades for the mystery to finally be solved. In 1980, Mildred McKinney is found beaten and strangled in her home. Henry Lee Lucas claims he and his partner in crime, Otis Toole, killed her. When Lucas recants his confession, the case is reopened. 25 years later, Williamson County investigator John Foster is assigned the McKinney case.
It was the worst homicide that I'd ever seen. It was an elderly woman murdered in her sleep and tortured before murdered. Fortunately, the crime scene technician had enough sense to collect DNA. It was put into basically an identification system. And I had to hope for a hit based off of the DNA. I came across a really nice picture of Mildred. And I put that on my desk just to remind me every day that maybe today will be the day that something happens with this case. I was in my car and I got a phone call. They said, well, we've got a suspect for you. And I couldn't believe it. Our suspect was identified as Stephen Allen Thomas.
Stephen Allen Thomas was from the Austin area. He had been in and out of trouble, but no offenses that required a DNA sample until 2012, when he was stopped by a federal DEA task force in South Texas for transporting a large amount of marijuana.
Thomas, now 53, has been released on bond, but he's wearing an ankle bracelet, so it's easy for Foster to track him down in the Dallas area. When Foster brings Thomas in for questioning, he denies any involvement in the crime.
And then I showed him the picture of Mildred McKinney that showed her beaten, hogtied, blood all over the ceiling, blood in the bed, her on the floor with furniture stacked on top of her. And I'd never seen somebody start sweating so bad. At that point, I felt 100% that I was talking to Mildred McKinney's murderer.
Foster and his team develop a theory for Thomas's motive. When Mildred was killed, Thomas was working part-time for a pest control company.
My feeling is that Stephen did pest control in Mildred's home. He saw that she looked to be someone that had a lot of money. My feeling is that Stephen saw this as, when I need drug money, I can come here and get it. I can get the silverware, I can get the jewelry.
In July 2012, Stephen Allen Thomas is charged with capital murder. Thomas continues to maintain his innocence.
When Mildred was murdered, Bob was a child. And the memories that he had of Mildred were of Grandma.
During the trial, hearing all the details of her death, it was the most horrific thing I'd ever had to listen to, far beyond anything you see in the movies. But the entire time, I would not allow myself to leave. I continued to tell myself that she had no capability to leave her situation, and I wasn't going to leave. I had to stand by her.
After a two-week trial, Stephen Allen Thomas is found guilty of the murder of Mildred McKinney. He is sentenced to death.
I remember the first thing that kind of popped into my head was sort of an inert need to share it with my mother, which was an impossibility because she had passed away on New Year's Day 2012.
Bob Stapleton's father, Robert, once the prime suspect in Mildred's murder, also passed away in 2011. Otis Toole died of cirrhosis in a Florida state prison on September 15th, 1996. Henry Lee Lucas remained on death row at the Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville. In 1998, Lucas was just days away from execution for a crime he insisted he did not commit.
Why don't they prove that I did the crime? You understand? They ain't proved nothing.
Governor Bush, a law and order type guy, commuted Henry's death sentence to life imprisonment.
His confession, now recanted, was the only evidence which linked him to the crime. Today's knowledge about his pattern of lies raises doubt.
On March 12, 2001, Henry Lee Lucas died in prison of natural causes.
The dead, whether they were killed by Henry or not, suffered. The families of the dead who didn't know what happened to their children suffered. I'm not sure there's a moral to the story, but there is something hopeful in science. The DNA now is growing ever more accurate.
I would encourage families that have had to go through this, for lack of terms, bug your law enforcement agency. Don't let this case become a cold case. Make sure that they're looking into it and encourage them not to give up either.
Who could have thought that after 32 years that some justice could still come to our family? I'll admit I gave up hope, and hope found us.